This is Think Out Loud on OPB and KLCC. I'm Dave Miller. Kids these days, am I right? With their neediness, their lack of resilience, their fragility, their sexually promiscuous hookup culture, things were different when I was growing up. We were different. It's a caricature, of course, of a kind of generational attack against people in high school and college, but it's not that far off from the kinds of things you read in books and articles and op-eds. That, in short, kids these days really are different. The University of Portland sociologist Martin Monto is skeptical about that idea, and he says he has a good reason to be skeptical because the data doesn't necessarily support it. Martin Monto, welcome to Think Out Loud.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let's start with some basics. What's the age group that you're focused on?
I'm really exploring the age group high school and college students and recently graduated college students. So sometimes it's called the I generation. Sometimes it's called the post-millennial generation. Really, these conceptions of generations are a little artificial anyway, though.
What first got you interested in the stereotypes that you were hearing about and then potentially trying to debunk them?
Well, really, it was an opportunity. I had a student that was interested in studying hookup culture. There was a famous book called Hooking Up that had just been published. It described this kind of no-holds-barred hookup culture on college campuses. The sociologist – it was a good book actually, but the sociologist lived in the residence halls with college students for a couple of years and reported a kind of very, very much a casual sex culture. This student was interested in that book. We had had a famous theologian who'd written a couple books on this generation and how difficult they're – what a difficult time they're having with this hookup culture. And she said, I want to study this. I said, well, do you think it's really true? And she said, I think so. It's what I've heard. It's what – you know, it's consistent with my experience. I said, well, let's see if there's any data on this. And I was stunned to find out there's tremendous resources in terms of data that can really help answer the question as to whether things really are different today than they had been. So in that study, we used general social survey data, which is a nationally representative survey of adults in the United States. And we looked at college and recent college graduates from 1986 through 94, which is my cohort, and compared them to 2004 through 2012, which was kind of the hookup culture cohort that was being described. And we learned that really – there is no pernicious culture of casual sex on college campuses. In fact, this generation of college students has a little bit less sex than my cohort did. They're not more likely to start out earlier. They don't have more partners. They don't have more sex. None of the kind of more sensationalized versions of this hookup culture were correct.
Well, how do you explain that? Because it wasn't just this one sociological book that you were talking about where this was out there. It's just it seemed to be pervasive. You could find a lot of examples of people saying some version of kids these days, they really are having more sex, more casual partners, that said something has changed. I mean, how do you explain that?
Well, honestly, I don't want to exaggerate the findings because to some degree, some aspects have changed. There's less stigma associated with casual sex or having sex with a person who's not your boyfriend or girlfriend. So some things have changed, but part of it is a change in terminology. So we really have kind of a different understanding of this idea of sex without a commitment. So the term hooking up is part of the problem. It emerged during this era, and it's fascinating because we looked at when this term emerged, and it really blossomed in the early 2000s and exploded after that. And hooking up is an ambiguous term. So we had a big national study that said 75% of college students hook up in the previous year. And this was quite exciting and alarming to the media. But hooking up was actually defined in that survey by things that my generation would have called making out. It didn't involve sexual intercourse.
I remember that actually in the 90s, in the mid and late 90s, that it was when I was in college, it was confusing then and ambiguous and a sort of all-encompassing term that went from, you know, kissing to a lot more.
Exactly. And I think it's deliberately ambiguous for this generation. That way they can say, well, I hooked up. We hooked up. And they don't have to say what it really meant. Hmm. So I think that's one of the issues. But it's also the fact that we are confronted with idiosyncratic examples. And we can find places where this has happened or people who have engaged in casual sex or even small subcultures scattered here and there. But the problem – the challenge is – we don't expose these kind of idiosyncratic observations to really larger, more generalizable data. And so that's really what we see happening. But I think the other thing is that there's just a tendency to – for older generations to look at younger generations and see them as alarming or problematic. And, you know, the concern about college student sexuality or young person's sexuality is nothing new. I mean, we've had – I actually have a quote from a medieval priest in the 1600s or no, it's even before that, that describes the promiscuity of the younger generation even back then. So I think it's kind of a sociological tendency to look askew at the younger generation, see them as crazy or less adequate or all these other stereotypes. So that's really what got me started. That study was so fascinating to me. I thought, what other cultural stereotypes or, you know, popular truth claims is there data to evaluate and really whether they're true? So I started to really become a skeptic of these claims about this generation.
So what other areas then did you look at?
Well, so far, the other area that we've researched more thoroughly is claims about this generation's mental health. There are claims that there's a mental health crisis among contemporary students, that this generation has unprecedented levels of depression and anxiety. Now, I don't want to underplay the importance of mental health, and I think one of the reasons we're getting increased concern about this issue and alarm about this issue is a greater awareness of the importance of mental health and less stigma in terms of admitting and dealing with mental health issues.
Well, in other words, You're saying it's possible that the reason there is more reporting of mental health issues of various kinds is that people are seeking treatment as opposed to an increase in absolute rates?
That's right. That's what I'm arguing. There have been subtle increases and decreases. If you look at – and we do have tremendous trend data where we ask people about, you know, suicidal thoughts and feeling sad for the past 2 weeks or even, you know, self-injury, which we're going to be talking about in a moment. But we have a tremendous trend data on anxiety and all these things that have been asked to representative samples of college and high school students for long periods of time. So we can tell whether in general students are experiencing greater levels of anxiety and depression and other kind of mental distress. And there are little ups and downs, and there may be a slight uptick in the 2017 to 2013 numbers, but not really alarming levels. Really, the numbers are not alarmingly different. What we do see, for example, on a college campus is there's a dramatic increase in the proportion of students that seek help through college counseling centers. So when we survey college counseling or health center directors, they say, we've got an epidemic on our hands. We've got dramatic increases in the number of students that are seeking service. Now, part of that is due to the fact that there's less stigma and it's more acceptable to seek treatment.
Do you see that as a good news story?
I think it's partly a good news story. I really do.
Let's turn to another aspect of the either the mental health or the socialization of the generation or the age group you're talking about, mm-hmm. which has been called the fragile generation in mm-hmm. some places. Mm-hmm. The idea being that they're so coddled, they've been so taken care of by helicopter parents who try to prevent any potential harm or adversity from hitting them that they can't handle criticism or adversity. They're not ready to be adults. Is there any way – I mean given your overall – desire right now to try to apply rigorous data and big survey information to these ideas, is there any way to actually look at data for something that seems as squishy as what I just described?
That's a great question. But there is some data that can lend insight into this issue. Some of the surveys ask questions about the students' commitments to things like serving others, like being open to different ideas. To their political perspectives, it is squishy. We're not going to come up with a solid set of numbers and be able to compare them to previous sets of students and say these students are this much less or more resilient than previous students, or they're this much more or less hypersensitive than previous students. But I think we have reason to question a lot of the generalizations that we see about this generation. You can surely find – I think some of the criticisms of this generation, the coddled, the helicopter parents, the hyper-scheduled. First of all, the hyper-scheduled one, we do have trend data that shows that students aren't spending more time or aren't spending more time on homework and school activities than they were in the past. So we have some data that can address some of
these
issues.
That's surprising because I thought that one was real, that kids are – they're going to more lessons and more structured sports and they have less time to run around and have unstructured playtime.
I think it's true for some categories, some students. I actually think there's a middle class bias in these observations because I think among among middle and upper middle class families, there's a sense of that meritocracy may be crumbling and we have to fight hard to make sure our kids are prepared to compete in the global marketplace. But this isn't really that. I don't think the evidence supports that this is happening on a much broader scale.
Let's turn to what you hinted at, which is actually your most recent study, which in some ways maybe complicates what we've been talking about.
Right.
You look into data about the rates of self-harm by young people, I think by high schoolers in particular.
Exactly, high schoolers.
What kinds of activities, first of all, would this include?
Well, the most common self-injury – we're talking about non-suicidal self-injury where somebody is trying to hurt themselves or hurting themselves on purpose without intending to kill themselves. And the most common are things like cutting, burning oneself, hitting oneself, sometimes bruising oneself, sometimes puncturing oneself. Those are some of the ones that we see that are most common. So those are the activities we're talking about.
What did you find when you looked at the data?
Okay. Now, this is going to – contradict, maybe appear to contradict what I've been talking about because I don't want to cause alarm when we're talking about this contemporary generation. But we have outstanding data from non-clinical populations of high school students in 11 states that suggest that about 1 in 4 girls in high school and about 1 in 10 boys in high school deliberately hurt themselves without trying to kill themselves in a given year.
How do you explain that given everything you were saying earlier?
That's – well, for one, we don't know if it's a trend. So I'm not saying this is – we haven't really been asking this question. This is a voluntary question that's asked to the CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Survey. And not all states ask the question. And it was only – it only started to be asked in about 2013 or 2000 – maybe 2011 as well, maybe 2009 in Vermont. But this wasn't asked, so we don't know if it's a trend.
In other words, it's possible that these numbers would have been just as potentially alarming 20 years ago. It's just that we don't have data from that time.
It's possible.
You don't necessarily – I mean, so do you – this gets in the realm, I suppose, of guessing. But do you think that there is a trend here?
Sociologists, we have to use the best available data and we have to make sure that we don't overstate what we're finding. I have looked at the 2017 data, the 2013 data, and the 2011 data, and I do not see in that short period of time a substantial increase in non-suicidal self-injury. So it's possible that this is something that's been going on for a long time, or it's possible that it is more common now than it used to be. So that's as close as I can, the best guess I can give you.
What are the research questions that you're excited to follow up on? I mean, if it seems like there is a lot we don't know, what do you most want to figure out?
Well, as a sociologist, I'm really curious as to whether first of all, there's tremendous variation from state to state. In some states, self-injury is almost twice as high as in other states. So that indicates that either the experience of youth in some of those places is more difficult or it could indicate that there's kind of a subculture among youth where this kind of activity is communicated and learned. This isn't necessarily something you just invent out of thin air. If you hear that somebody's doing it or you learn about it, you may be more curious about it. So it may be a communication by subculture. It may be that adolescence is experienced differently in different states. To me, those are fascinating. I'm also really curious about what this means to the people that do it. Now, many people that have participated in this activity and are now adults say, I was not intending to kill myself. I did it for other reasons. Now, that's beyond my area of expertise, but what it means to the people that participate is fascinating. So
I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is that the kids these days sentiment is nothing new. It goes back literally centuries. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that more than anything else, it's a demonstration of jealousy, some idea that young people without mortgages and kids and bosses, that they're having more fun than you are? The get off my lawn. It's like, you wish you could play on lawn and right. these promiscuous kids having more sex, you wish you were having more
sex.
If
I had extra time, I'd self-injure, but I was too busy working. No, I think there are a lot of those stereotypes that are still floating around. I don't know if it's jealousy. I think it's a tendency to sentimentalize or, the past, some nostalgia. Back when I was a – I see the posts on Facebook. Back when I was a kid, I rode bikes without helmets all the time. Like if you think just this generation is wimpy or something like that. So I think this is a consistent tendency that we see floating around. And I think it's nostalgia. I think it's also – honestly, there are changes. And it's a lack of understanding of contemporary generations and the realities they confront. This generation does have a different reality. They do spend – there are things that have changed. I'm not saying nothing changes. They spend less time outside. They spend much more time on social media. It's kind of a lack of understanding of the real experiences of this generation and kind of an alarm. And some of it's concern. Maybe some of it's jealousy. They're so taken care of and they're so protected and I had to make it, that kind of thing.
Martin Monto, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Martin Monto is a professor of sociology at the University of Portland. Tomorrow on the show, tolls on I-5 and I-205 are still years away, but the Oregon Department of Transportation is getting closer to a plan. What do you think tolling would mean for you, for your finances, your driving habits, your neighborhood? You can leave us a voicemail right now at 503-293-1983. Again, spark our conversation for tomorrow, 503-293-1983. Thanks very much for tuning in today. I'm Dave Miller. We will join you tomorrow.
Support for Think Out Loud is provided by the Rose E. Tucker Charitable Trust and Susan Hammer and Lee Kelly.